Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm coming out. I want the world to know. I got to let it show. I'm coming out. I want the world to know. I got to let it show.
Diana Ross playing us into the Brian Lehrer Show this hour with her 1979 hit, I'm Coming Out, as it's part two now of our six-part World Pride Month series, Prejudice and Pride, Decade by Decade Since Stonewall. We'll have great guests for each decade since 1969, the year of Stonewall, all this week, decade by decade, and take lots of your oral history calls. So let's talk about prejudice and LGBT pride in the 1970s. In 1973, 29-year-old Billie Jean King trounced 55-year-old Bobby Riggs in a game of tennis that became known as the Battle of the Sexes, but not before some sexist banter ahead of the big game.
Personally, I wish the women would stay in the home and do the kitchen work and take care of the babies, because we're going to put those women right back where they belong, like they used to be when we had the slippers and pipe, the rush of the pipe and the slippers, and they were around the house, they were home builders, they didn't try to get out and get the man's job away from them, and now when they can't even do it half as good, they still want the same kind of money.
Since 1939, you've never had it so good.
If they think you're all washed up at 30, which you're not, because you want to...
I'm 29!
How do you think I feel at 55?
That's Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King managing to keep it humorous, even amid some of that language. And the King versus Riggs exhibition match was not considered about LGBT issues at the time. It was considered about gender. But King is now considered a feminist and a lesbian icon, and she didn't have agency in her own coming out story. Her secret affair with Marilyn Barnett began in 1971, ended in 1979, and King was forcibly outed when they broke up. And the 1970s women's lib movement, as it was called at the time, and the LGBT movement intersected but sometimes clashed. Here's Margaret Sloan, one of the first editors of Gloria Steinem's Ms. Magazine, speaking about the environment in the early 1970s for feminist lesbians.
The women's movement did a very serious and harmful thing in the second wave of the women's movement by not including the issues and demands of lesbian women. And that's, I understand it on a rational basis, because, I mean, the first thing that the men called us on those picket lines, well, you're just a bunch of dykes. And the women recoiled in horror and ran home, you know. And this was sort of something that was used against us. I mean, obviously, if you want to be liberated, you must be pushy and aggressive and everything else, and then a lesbian. And so many straight women in the movement who were very much afraid of being labeled did great damage and harm to lesbians by purging them.
Margaret Sloan, one of the early editors of Ms., best remembered as a black feminist, lesbian, and civil rights advocate. In 1978, in San Francisco, Harvey Milk became the first openly gay elected official in the history of California, where he was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Here is Harvey Milk making his debut speech that year, in which elected officials introduced their spouses.
It is well known that I'm a gay person, and in this state, there is a law that says gay people cannot be married, but there is no law that says two human beings cannot love one another. I have a loved one. Unfortunately, he is too nervous to be here. He left.
That from the NBC News archive. And then just a few short months later, on November 27th, 1978, came the news that Harvey Milk was assassinated. Here is Dianne Feinstein, who you all know is senator from California these days. Then she was president of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, announcing the shocking news.
President of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
The... The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
And finally, on October 14th, 1979, in an event that LGBT advocates and political observers considered a historic first, the LGBT people from all around the country came to the nation's capital for the nation's first national march on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. It was really large. Here is writer, feminist, womanist, librarian, and civil rights activist Audre Lorde on that day.
I am proud to raise my voice here this day as a black lesbian feminist committed to struggle for a world where all our children can grow free from the diseases of racism, of sexism, of classism, and of homophobia. For those oppressions are inseparable. The question always is, what kind of a world do we want to be a part of?
Audre Lorde at the March for Lesbian and Gay Rights in Washington, D.C. in October of 1979. Hope you enjoyed those archive audio clips. Now, a central part of this series all this week is your oral history calls. We will focus on a different decade each show. Our oral history question for today, for any LGBTQ listeners who were around at that time, is how did you express your pride and how did you experience prejudice in the 1970s? Tell us a story that's an important memory for you from the 70s now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. How did you express your pride and how did you experience prejudice in the 1970s? And if you were at the March for Lesbian and Gay Rights in Washington in October 1979, we invite you to call and tell us something you remember from that day or that week. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And joining me now with some of her thoughts on that decade in LGBTQ history is Esther Newton, cultural anthropologist who helped to establish the field of LGBTQ studies, retired professor of women's studies at the University of Michigan, and author of several books, including My Butch Career, a memoir. Professor Newton, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I've been for years.
Thank you so much. And let's begin with that march on Washington in 1979. An estimated 200,000 people attended from all over the country, and it was the first time the LGBT community marched en masse on the Capitol. Can you explain the significance of that event?
It's just so huge. Let me just say I was there and went on it, and it was the, you know, in barely over a decade, LGBT people came from being classified as mentally ill, as being subject to arbitrary police raids and police violence, who had some level of resistance, organized resistance, but nothing like what happened after Stonewall. So this was the first national, everything before that had been more local, you know, city by city, and this was the first national manifestation of the power that Stonewall had to reach out all around the world, really.
And you mentioned the psychological establishment. One of the history notes I have here is the American Psychiatric Association made history by issuing a resolution stating that homosexuality was not a mental illness or sickness in 1973, so that was 4 years after Stonewall.
Well, that was huge, absolutely, and it didn't happen without protest either. It turns out, later we learned, that there were people inside the Psychiatric Association who wanted this change. And then there was push from the outside, from the gay and lesbian, as it was then called, movement, where they actually showed up at the convention and protested. And it was just amazing. I mean, I myself was almost committed to a hospital when I was 16.
Really?
That's a lot of people's stories.
Jim in Manhattan remembers the 1979 march. Jim, thank you so much for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
What do you want to remember about that?
I went to the march in 79. I had never been east of Albuquerque, so I took a train cross country, and I was just overwhelmed, and I came up to visit New York after the march, and I fell in love with the place. I moved here then in the spring of 80, and I've been here ever since. It was like a turning point in my life.
Jim, thank you so much for that memory. And the march, on a policy level, as I understand it, was hoping to push President Jimmy Carter at the time to sign a bill to stop all discrimination against gays and lesbians in the military and in federal jobs under his jurisdiction. Marchers demanded that Congress include sexual orientation in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as well. So how did that all play out in terms of their policy demands?
Well, those things didn't happen. Not right away, certainly. But the impact was more, I mean, first of all, to formulate demands like this, which had started in the 1950s with the homophile movement, just to formulate them and present them on a national stage was so hugely important. And but the immediate impact was more because of the national representation and those demands being made, that it just galvanized queer people everywhere.
Elaine in West Milford, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi.
Hi.
What do you want to remember?
Well, I remember that I was living in San Francisco at the time of this incident, and I happened to be working for a private investigating firm.
Forgive me, by the incident, you mean the assassination of Supervisor Harvey Milk, right?
Correct. And we were charged with investigating the backgrounds of people that were interested in taking his place. As I said earlier, a lot of the reason that the entire LGBTQ community got so up in arms is the way the police were investigating the murders. It was like, well, another gay person's dead, so what? Very, 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 like they didn't really care. None of that made the papers. None of it was on the news. Naturally, that caused a huge uproar within that community.
And then were you there when Dan White, the killer of Harvey Milk, was not convicted on murder charges, but rather something less based on his Twinkie defense, the famous Twinkie defense, I guess sort of too much sugar made me do it?
And once again, that shows you perfectly what the climate was at the time. That exactly demonstrates what the climate was at the time. Another gay guy's dead, so what? You know, we'll get over it. No great loss.
Were you there for, I mean, people on this coast talk about the Stonewall riots. Maybe they talk about it all over the country. But the White Knight riots, as they came to be known, when that conviction on manslaughter as opposed to murder came down. Were you there in San Francisco for that?
Yes. Yes. Actually, it's I was living on Sutter Street, which is a half a block from the main drag, Castro Avenue. And I have to say, I'm a straight female, but I have to say I was with everyone 100%. I don't care if the person that was murdered was gay, straight, an immigrant, whatever. The way that case was handled was deplorable. Deplorable.
Thank you so much for your call, and for people who don't know that history, so instructive. Thank you very much. We'll continue in a minute with Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall. We're in the 1970s today. And again, our oral history question for anyone else who wants to call in is, how did you express your pride and how did you experience prejudice in the 1970s? Tell us a story that's an important memory for you from the 70s at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Make me feel mighty real, Sylvester 1978. Brian Lehrer on WNYC in our series Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall. your oral history calls on how you experienced prejudice or pride as an LGBTQ person in the 1970s, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we continue with Esther Newton, cultural anthropologist who helped to establish the field of LGBTQ studies, retired professor of women's studies at the University of Michigan, and author of several books, including My Butch Career, a memoir. Professor, in the clip we played earlier of Margaret Sloan, the lesbian who said the women's movement did a very serious and harmful thing in the second wave of the women's movement by not including the issues and demands of lesbian women. Betty Friedan, as I understand the history, the iconic feminist writer and activist who wrote the 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, rejected lesbians as part of her second wave feminist movement. Sloan said she purged the women's movement of lesbians. Is that the history as you understand it?
Absolutely. And one of the most important things that happened in the 70s was the Lavender Menace zap, you might say, which happened at the Second Congress to Unite Women. And this was a group of affiliated lesbians who protested the rejection of lesbians from the feminist movement. They also distributed a broadside, I guess you'd say, called Woman Identified Woman, which was the founding document of lesbian feminism. And just to put it in perspective, in the early 70s, you had a very strong separatist, lesbian separatist movement that was also about protesting male dominance within the liberation movement and became a very important cultural and movement that also founded publications, bookstores, shelters for battered women, and the annual women-only celebration, the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which inspired similar festivals around the country.
Let's take another phone call. Larry in Lower Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Larry.
Well, hello, and thanks very much. Okay, I'm 73. In 1971, I had just recently got out of the Army and had moved to New York in 68 and had made a relationship with a really terrific guy called Jack. And Jack and I decided in 1971 that we were going to go back home to my hometown in Nebraska and meet my parents. Now, as I told your screener, I had no realization at the time that that was a courageous act, but it really was. And we went to Nebraska for Christmas. We had a great time. I have a large Catholic family. And the two people that my wonderful friend Jack charmed the most was my grandmother and my father, both of whom I thought would be most closed-mouthed and resistant to him. It was a fantastic memory, and I'm so pleased that you brought it up again. Jack was taken by HIV in 1986. Mm-hmm.
Larry, I'm sorry for your loss. We're going to be talking a lot about the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s on tomorrow's program, and thank you so much for your memory. Ellen in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Brian, thank you for your excellent program. And the only thing I really want to say is that I was at many of these marches. I'm not sure if I was at Stonewall, but there were successive marches in June, gay marches in June, and also the women's marches in August. And I'm sure I was pretty much at all of them. And the point that I really want to make is how consistently the New York Times underreported the sheer number of people who were at and protesting at these events. I think there was the second march after Stonewall that I was at, and that march stretched from Stonewall in the Village and packed to 34th Street and 5th Avenue, and the Times made it sound like there were just like a few hundred people at these marches, and it was not like that at all.
Ellen,
so,
thank
record. Uh-huh. The Times, I don't know where the Times was when they were looking at these marches, but they were substantially bigger than has been reported.
But what are you saying? Are you saying that your experience at the time was that the New York Times, you know, liberal newspaper, all of that, had some agenda to falsely diminish in the public's view the number of people at pro-LGBTQ protests?
I really didn't know what to think of it. I was, you know, very young. I was like probably 21 years old and new to all of this. And, you know, I can't get over the fact, I couldn't get over the fact at the time that these huge, and they were protest marches, they were not parades.
Mm-hmm.
People were angry. People were out and they were, you know, wanting to show that, you know, they did not want what was going down. And so, you know, the thing that I remember very clearly is climbing up on a telephone post on 34th Street and 5th Avenue and looking at the sea of people that were packed all the way down 5th Avenue.
Thank you so much for your memory, Ellen. We really appreciate it. Professor Newton, let me get back to the question of intersectionality in general, because we played two clips of black feminist, the poet Audre Lorde, and Ms. Magazine editor Margaret Sloan. You were addressing what today would be shocking to people to hear, the divide between straight feminists and lesbian feminists in the 1970s. Can you speak to the emerging intersectionality and where it was at that time? Nobody was using that word at that time.
No.
But where it was at that time and how what happened after that controversy over Betty Friedan, you know, labeling the so-called lavender menace of lesbians?
Well, in 1971, something called the Black Lesbian Caucus was formed. And it was an offshoot of the Gay Activists Alliance, which was another offshoot of Gay Liberation Front, and it was made up of black and Latina lesbians. And in 1974, the group renamed itself the Salsa Soul Sisters, which I believe it's still in existence. And Latina and black lesbians were not as inclined towards separatism, because of the issues they shared with black and Latino men, in other words, racism. And you really hear that in Audre Lorde's speech at the 1979 march, that the gay liberation movement was pictured by the media and thought of as by many people as basically white men. And there are lots of others of us that played prominent roles in the movement, and also had to sort of band together to make ourselves heard, visible, represented.
Jim in Maine, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Brian. I'm a big, big fan of the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to note that I was in the theater in the 1970s, living in New York. Came in 1971. I'm a straight male, but many of us in the theater were accepting gay rights, you know, long before others sort of caught on later in the 70s and the 80s. And one of my best friends, a playwright, was gay, and I was best man in his wedding in 1978. And I remember distinctly going down to Hell's Kitchen and just people wearing white robes, and it was a very joyous thing, and of course very few people were doing this at the time. And also to note that the film The Times of Harvey Milk, which came out in 1984, reflected the assassination, and it was one of the first LGBT documentaries to come out, and a real game changer, just of all documentaries.
In fact, that documentary, I believe, won an Academy Award for Best Documentary. It won two Emmys and a Peabody.
It did. It was, and especially the music of Mark Isham, which just rings in my head today, you know, and makes me think of the Harvey Milk incident, and but very, very powerful film that people should know about.
And thank you for that memory. And I think we have one other Harvey Milk memory. If I can get to line three, is he ready to go? Can I take that? Brian in Shark River Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brian, how you doing? I was just saying that, you know, I lived in Greenwich Village in the 60s and 70s before moving to San Francisco, and I just wanted to point out there was a large segment of people that were neither gay nor lesbian, but were very intimate with that community and ended up being major supporters. And the funny thing was, the bar I used to drink in Greenwich Village was an straight Irish writer's bar called the Lion's Head. And we were two doors down from the Stonewall. And when all hell broke loose, I mean, we kind of diplomatically supported the gay and lesbian community and welcomed them into our bar for, you know, convivial drink. And then when I was about 22, I moved to San Francisco. And within a few weeks, Harvey Milk was collecting signatures for his candidacy in front of the Haight-Ashbury post office. And he stopped me and asked for my signature. I didn't really, you know, being a young guy and being, you know, straight, I didn't really know what was going on. But I thought he was very cool. I signed his petition, and he was really lovely, really kind. And next thing you know, a year later, he was assassinated. I just wanted to point out there were large segments of the community that would later support the gay and lesbian rights movement. But at first, you know, we didn't really understand it. When I was a young kid, I really didn't understand the whole thing until years later.
Thank you so much for those memories. I really appreciate them. And we're just about out of time. Professor Newton, anything you want to reflect on the way out, maybe from those that last set of callers or anything else?
Well, I did want to mention one other thing about intersectionality, which is to bring up Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, who were black and Latina and black, respectively. 1973 was a really big year for lots of things, wonderful things happening in the gay movement. But I was actually there when Sylvia Rivera in 1973 pled for representation for people of color and street queens, as they were then called, within the gay community, and was booed and shouted down by lots of people in the audience for different reasons. It was a very moving experience to me, and I'm someone who studied drag queens, and I knew that they were out there and they were part of our world and part of our movement, and that's really the beginning of the transgender movement that has become so important today. So there's your intersectionality.
In the 1970s. So
in the 1970s, yes.
Esther Newton, cultural anthropologist who helped to establish the field of LGBTQ studies, a retired professor now of women's studies at the University of Michigan, and author of several books, including My Butch Career, a memoir. Thank you so much for helping us out so beautifully today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, tune in tomorrow for Pride and Prejudice and Pride 1989, including the AIDS epidemic and more. We'll speak to Peter Staley, an American political activist known for his work in LGBT rights and HIV/AIDS activism, and more of your oral history calls as Prejudice and Pride moves into the 1980s on tomorrow's Brian Lehrer Show.
Stop me now. I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball.